And welcome to another amazing episode of the Six Star Business Podcast. Here I am,
hooray,
Aveline Clark, you're one of your co-hosts, along with my fine friend in the UK. I was going to say something cute and cheeky then, but it just didn't happen. Pete, lovely to see you. Welcome.
It's good to be here, as always, with you, Aveline. Yep, and welcome back, because you've been away relaxing in the sun and whatever, I guess. How was it?
Yeah, I like that, and whatever. So let me fill in what the whatever is. So yes, I was away. There was a lot of sunshine. There was beach. There was surf. There was rock pools, picking up shells. The whatever kind of consisted of whatever we wanted to do, really. And that was pretty low key. You know, those times where you just don't have any plans and the kids go, you know what? We're chilling. We've got the pool. We've got the beach. No, we don't need to see any sights. We don't need to go anywhere. Let's just chill. We'll get a movie, watch a movie a day. And we read a lot of books. So The only whatever activity that we did, we get some healings. That there's a healer there, osteopath I've known for 15 years, and the family always sees him and his wife. He has a thriving clinic there and he does this amazing neuro-linking technique. Anyway, we all go and get treatments. And after the treatments, you're kind of a bit spaced out physically, mentally, all of that. You don't really want to do anything. So the whatever was perfect. So we did all that. We went to a local bookstore. We bought about 10 books for the family and we read books and walked around. And, you know, I did check emails. No, actually, I lie. I didn't really check emails. I just checked in with my team, the staff, just to make sure they were okay every day and the evenings. But that was it.
And you know what? Just as you were talking there seems to me to be an element of having a six-star business in what you've just described from a business owner's perspective. I know with the conversations we've been talking about customer experience and employee engagement and psychological safety and stuff, but from the business owner's perspective, if their business does not allow them to go and have the kind of experiences that you had last week, then you could argue that it's not a six-star business from the business owner's perspective. So So well done you for having a six-star business.
A six-star experience. Sorry,
that side of it. So, you know, business as usual. I held the fort. Nothing went on fire. So, not that I'm aware of, anyway.
So can I go away?
Did happen is we signed up for Matchmaker.fm, that community that links podcast guests with podcasts. Yeah. And I did book a couple of guests for the future while you're away. So I wasn't just sitting on my backside twiddling my thumbs. And one of those guests is the founder of Matchmaker.fm. So really, really excited about that. But there's conversations. Yeah. So cool. So listen, talking about guests and six-star business, we better get on with it. Who have we got with us today?
We have Kevin, who's in Cyprus. Yep. Is that right? Cyprus? And Kevin Burt, and we've got Chris Thornhill from the UK. So I was the odd one out. I am the odd one out in this podcast episode, but I will put a little spoiler alert in that if you like sport and you like a bit of controversy, listen up. This is a really good episode.
See you on the other side. Hey, welcome everybody. I think we're fewer time zones on this call than we have had recently. Kevin, remind me what time zone, are you UK time zone?
I'm on Eastern European time. I'm currently sat in Cyprus at the moment.
Yeah, wow.
That's right. Yes, I remember. So you're not too far off us. This is the Six Star Business Podcast. As you heard in the intro, I am Pete Daly-Dixon, one of your co-hosts, and joined on this call, along with Aveline, my co-host, two guests, Chris Thornhill and Kevin Burt. Welcome, gents.
Thank you.
So just at the top of the show, we just like to give our listeners a bit of an insight into who they are going to be listening to for the next 45 minutes or so. So Chris, who are you? How are you? Where are you? It's great to see you again.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, so I'm Chris and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Growth Animals. We're a remote-based marketing agency that are based in the south of England. We were formed only last year, actually, during the pandemic. We were three people who were all working together client side for a big employer, the Goodwood Estate, in their marketing team. And in effect, used the pandemic as an excuse to sort of jump ship and do a marketing agency the way we wanted to. Our whole philosophy is around doing ethical growth marketing. The idea is to help businesses to grow both their bottom line, but also their positive impact. And so we talk about this idea of ethical marketing, where we're helping businesses to do a form of marketing that helps and inspires consumers rather than persuades and manipulates them. And I guess it all kind of comes from the fact that when we left Goodwood, we knew that we were three people who knew how to do marketing. We had a track record of growing brands and stuff, but we wanted to put a stamp on it, you know, have our values running through it. And ultimately, I'm a father to a four-year-old daughter, and I want her to be proud of the business that I build up over time. So that's kind of what runs through it and what's been our motivation for it so far.
Beautiful.
Right. And when Chris isn't at work at Growth Animals, what flicks the switch? What do you get up to? Apart from having your hands full with a four-year-old daughter, of course.
Yeah, she keeps me entertained for sure. Other than that, though, I have been getting into exercise like a lot of people under lockdown, just for pure lack of other things to do. And that's also helped to outweigh my passion for whiskey, which otherwise could be quite dangerous without the exercise.
Kevin, welcome. Same questions to you. Good to have you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'll start with this. I guess I wear two hats. I am the CEO of two businesses, so my spare time is quite small. The first business is NSYNC 8020, which has grown and developed gradually over the world, over the last few years, from what started off initially as a kind of a generic process improvement consultancy, and then through our own learning about, you know, what people are finding relevant in business today and how things are changing, it kind of morphed and developed to where it is today. Now, and we look way beyond just kind of the simple process improvements, all the way through to taking strategy, considering how that strategy is then cascaded into business structures and systems and processes, but then also the organization structures and staff training and development, and of course, sustainability. So we've kind of, very similar to what Chris was describing, I think we recognized a number of years back that it wasn't just about the bottom line anymore. It wasn't just about cash generation. We started to kind of wrap an umbrella around all of the work that we did in terms of something that was triple bottom line approach. So lots of the markets that we actually tend to deliver our service to are considered not so environmentally friendly unless they're very well managed. So natural resources is where we spend quite a lot of our time. So being mindful around environmental concerns especially is key, but also the social licensing and communities that these assets are in also have to be given quite a lot of consideration. So it's enabled us to develop our service offering around triple bottom line, as well as the whole organizational needs. My other hat is in a software house company called iHandover, and they're focused predominantly on the different types of handover needs within a business. So two key products there, one's called Activate that looks at the larger transition of people onboarding, exiting, or potentially talent management through a business. And then the other piece of software, RelayWorks, has been designed around where people have to hand over their accountabilities on a 24/7, 365 operation. So two totally different types of service offering. And COVID, whilst I totally agree with Chris, it's given ourselves as well a great opportunity to stand back and just take a good hard look at ourselves in terms of how we deliver the services. But the software also generated quite a lot of interest from companies when they had to make that distinction between what is an essential worker. And that through COVID, I think there was this natural split or clear differentiator between the essential worker being somebody who actually has to be in the workplace to press the buttons or turn the switches or check the quality, versus management who are making a different type of decision where they make decisions based upon data and they need to have access to good, reliable data. So we found a lot of kind of customers came to us saying, we're coping through COVID, but we're recognizing that there is a difference between how we manage this business and who the essential worker is. And actually, the biggest question we had was from CEOs who were asking us, I've got this management structure and this management layer here, and I'm not certain that we're getting value for money. And the reason being, it wasn't that nobody was working hard or nobody was really able to add any value. It was just that they recognized, and I guess the magnifying glass was during COVID was placed over organization structures that allow people to kind of go, why does it take us so long to make decisions? So that's what we have all of these, you know, management layers for. Why is it taking us so long? What is it that we don't have that we need to be, you know, very fast-paced, flexible, and progressive? So yes, COVID for ourselves in terms of consultancy and software, but I think also for many other businesses, has been a necessary stopgap because we have to be ready for these types of events in the future. So I think it's been a great opportunity for people. So that's a little bit about, I guess, where I spend the majority of my time, a significant amount of my time. What do I do to kind of unwind and relax? I really enjoy diving. Deep sea diving. As I mentioned, I'm currently in Cyprus, which is a wonderful place to jump in the water. It's just about warm enough now. So, and just being in a totally different world, just even if it's only for 15 minutes, helps unwind and kind of process things. So, yeah.
Oh, beautiful. And Kevin, what do you love the most about your diving? Like, what's the most interesting or fascinating thing that you look for when you dive down?
A couple of things that I find are really kind of come together to make it a great experience. One is the silence. As consultants, we spend all of our time talking, so this silence is absolutely blissful. Just the different sea life that's there and available. But also the weightlessness, the balance, because people tend to think scuba diving is all about, you know, hard swimming, but actually a lot of it is about just creating balance and breathing well and slowing down and just taking in the moment. So for me, it only has to be 15 minutes and it can brighten your whole week up.
Love it.
I can see some similarities to skiing. I don't know if you're much of a skier, but especially when you can find a slope that's not full of people, that kind of natural silence and the wind and everything, and then you're completely concentrated on not crashing and it takes your mind away from everything else.
yeah, you know, I haven't really mentioned my children. I have three children, but they're not young children anymore. They're the eldest is kind of early 20s and my other two, son and daughter, kind of late teens. They all love the skiing and we go skiing quite often. Oh, when we can. Again, unfortunately, because of COVID, many people haven't been able to go this year, but to my youngest son made a jump across to Europe and spent the whole season in Austria because he said, well, if I've got to do a lockdown, I'll do it in Austria. So he spent the whole skiing season there. So I was quite jealous. But that what you talk about, Chris, that there is a kind of skiing on the piste with everybody around you, trying not to crash into people and cause any harm, which I really enjoy. And then there is that part where you are potentially alone on some off piste, not a lot of people around, and there is that tranquility. Also, I think when you're skiing and there's an awful lot of speed there and there's that exhilaration rushing through you can also, it can be quite transformative. I'll be honest though, I've landed up at the bottom of a mountain a couple of times when I've thought I was very lucky to get down. carrying my chickens and very helpful to very happy to be moving forward with being able to get on the next chairlift. Yeah.
Well, I love, as much as anything on these podcast recordings, I love just getting an insight into our guests and other humans that we're sharing the journey with. This is the Six Star Business Podcast, not the Six Star Sports Podcast.
Maybe that's damn it, really?
Maybe we can. What is it, Chris? They call brand extension or something? We can do with that. Yeah, the Six Star brand. Just on that, Chris and Kevin, I'll put the question out, and whoever wants to go first can run with it to start with. But when you heard of the idea, the concept, whatever, of a six-star business, what was it that attracted you to that idea, that concept initially, and held your interest long enough to want to give up a bit of time today to spend with Avalyn and me talking about it?
Well, I think initially the first thing is within its title itself, a six-star business. You tend to start to ask, well, what are the components you need to get six stars? What is the grading system? How would you evaluate something like that? And therein, then you generate an interest, because we all like to think we know what good business is about. We all like to think that following, you know, very large, successful businesses, they seem to have had or had lucky breaks or how did they get there? But actually, it's not. There is quite often some fundamentals that are required to be put in place for you to be able to grow a business and be successful. But the idea of a six-star business, actually qualifying it in some way and saying, here's what's required, here's the building steps, here's what you need to be able to get this certification or branding of being classed a six-star business, is, I think, very intriguing to any entrepreneur and business owner.
Yeah, I agree. And I guess knowing both you, Pete, and you, Evelyn, now as I do, I kind of knew that it's not going to be just that almost grading system like you have in hotels, perhaps, where it's very clearly about levels of service or luxury and so forth. There's going to be more to it. There's going to be more about the values, the culture behind them. So I think that makes it quite intriguing to discuss how the wider world can kind of understand that as well.
What does being a six-star business mean to you, Chris?
I think it has to have all the hygiene factors of a healthy business, from the usual things people would look at, like the, you know, financial metrics and commercial metrics, but then goes above and beyond that and has really healthy cultures where, you know, the people are looked after, they feel like they're really nurtured, part of a family, all that sort of thing. And the business also puts back and cares about society and the environment as well.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think your brand, your reputation means so much these days. It stands for something. It's not just necessarily something that you can attach to a company and that's it, complete. It has to mean something, both to the employees internally and to the external markets as well. Now, one of the pieces of work that we've been heavily involved in, which I think bring home the really qualifying elements of a six-star business, is we've been spending quite a lot of time with a different type of handover. So I mentioned earlier two different types of software handover. This is more consultative approach, where we've been focusing on the apex of the business, specifically the CEO role. And we've developed a kind of a product or a niche in the marketplace where we help CEOs kind of onboard with their first 90 to 100 days. And within that, there's kind of help and support in that new CEO coming into a business and taking a deep industry dive, a snapshot of where the business is today compared with its external competitors, the marketplace and the complexity of the marketplace that it's trying to operate in, the size of the business that they are trying to, you know, create a strategy for, and all of the necessary stakeholders and shareholders. So the investors in the business and the board and the executive teams all the way down to the operators. That's a lot of things that you have to kind of bring together and make sense of within 90 to 100 days. And then to be able to turn around and tell a compelling story that says, here's how we're going to move from where we are now to where we need to be in the future, and explain the reasons and the necessity for change and for movement. We've found that as we've developed that kind of product and service offering, there are a number of obstacles that have to be considered if you are going to develop, let's say, the six-star business. And you have to get everybody to buy into this. Everybody has to want to positively support any changes within the business, within this particular service offering. And it's quite amazing. We found that in general, when you are pulling together all of the different components of what makes a good sense-making story, compelling story that all of the different stakeholders could buy into, even though in this case we have a six-star business, we've found kind of almost a sweet spot of about 60 different iterative points or connections in a story that often need to be changed, developed, or matured in some way to be able to achieve a compelling story and get people moving in the right direction. So we initially kind of sat back and said, well, you know, for a business to be considered excellent, you know, to make it an evolutionary jump, you have to, first of all, cover perceptions and expectations of all stakeholders. And it's not that easy to summarize. So we've been on this learning journey as well with CEOs. It's not that easy to summarize, because anybody that you ask for input and dialogue with, there's also the expectation that they will get feedback at some point and that there'll be a demonstration that they've been listened to. So that managed to get that six-star business. Yes, you have to have the great idea. You have to have something that sells. It has to be able to generate money. But more importantly, nowadays, it is about how you manage all of your different stakeholders to achieve that. So we have all these hygiene factors from the staff, the operators, employees, who all have different needs, who have an expectation now of being listened to, being heard, being part of the organization's growth and development. The industry has just gone through a large, I'm going to say, buzzword click around diversity and inclusion. And it's amazing to think that, you know, the age of businesses today, that we have to re-educate ourselves in diversity and inclusion. But it's been absolutely necessary. It really has had to be necessary to make sure that we do solicit, engage all of the employees, and that we understand how to make people feel welcome in growing the businesses. So, yeah, I think to say that a six-star business, finance and being able to generate good profits is one thing, but business relevance is so much more important these days if you are going to achieve any type of qualification of a six-star business.
Yeah, and you're probably finding it, Kevin, it's interesting watching the wider sort of business world at the moment. It feels like a lot of the big established guys are having to reevaluate whether they do qualify now. And they're starting to get pushback from particularly the younger generation of their employees. You know, we're seeing that in the banking sector, the finance sector. And actually, you know, thinking about the past 24 hours, the six big Premier League clubs have shown how much they lack integrity and how much they don't even communicate with their core employees, like the actual players and the managers. And, you know, these absolute basics are sometimes being missed out. So it's quite incredible.
What's happened there?
Well, in a nutshell, the big six Premier League teams are threatening to leave the established football sort of pyramid and create a monopoly where all the cash goes to them and the fans, the sort of lower teams, are completely left to their own devices.
Yeah, it's almost creating like a super league with a members only club. And yeah, it's had a lot of fear and disgust from fans over the last 24, 48 hours. It's relatively new. But obviously, sport, football is something that many people are passionate about. And the kickback from those stakeholders is huge at the moment. And they are very passionate in how they go. And you're right, Chris. You know, it's the ability to understand the way that industry is going. I mean, there has been a structure, there has been an organization, there has been associations there holding that industry together for a long time. But also the desire to move from what was or what is currently to something new is something that has also been born out of frustration, that the institution and the governing bodies that were supporting it are no longer feel like they're relevant to these Super League, potential Super Leagues. And we've seen it in other places. We've seen it in other sports. So it's not like it hasn't been done before, but the frustrations have obviously built enough to have enough conversations in the background to generate something of this size and this momentum to a point where they feel like they can comfortably announce it and continue. And again, that's a little bit like lots of businesses, very similar to many other businesses who have an idea and inspiration and say that, you know, this is the direction that we're heading in. But without having the necessary feedback mechanisms from employees, from stakeholders, from shareholders as to whether. But you also have a flip side of that. It's very difficult to run a business by consensus. So somebody in that organization has to be ultimately held accountable for leadership and direction of the business. The key thing is, do they have the necessary input, sensory environment to consider how well any changes are going to be considered within that business? We've seen opportunities, I guess, throughout many of our consultant exercises where had a wider community been engaged, then the support would have been very long lasting for some of these businesses that unfortunately didn't make it. But also, if I just kind of use a very quick example of a different environment, there was a mining asset in Tanzania that relied heavily on the external community to make this asset run. But when it put in its infrastructure for its assets, it kind of dragged water from Lake Victoria into the asset and purified it in the actual compound where the mine was. Had they listened to the wider community, they would have been able to filter that water at source and provide nice clean water for all the communities all the way to the mining asset at no additional cost. That would have meant much healthier employees, less downtime and sickness for themselves, and it would have been generated. So I often think that when businesses start up, they have to really consider all of that external community, their supporters, their shareholders, stakeholders, and at least have a mechanism in place today. I think the important thing is, I think this is what I'm trying to get at, is the important thing is to have the necessary mechanisms in place to at least make sure that important views are at least being considered before the key strategy, stories, or changes are embedded and implemented.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's, yeah, absolutely. Making the mechanisms there, making them robust enough that those people that are part of those communication or feedback loops at the very least do feel considered and listened to. Because I think, again, to use the current example, what feels most unprecedented about it is that you've got a situation where the key people in the country, so like the UK government, feel completely out of the loop and therefore have reacted with a knee jerk unlike anything else. You've got the managers of the teams who are, you know, asked directly by journalists in press conferences before a match and feel completely exposed and therefore have gone against the narrative already. So yeah, in my time, I can't think of many examples of where it's been so botched in terms of a communication job. And it's the basics, really, isn't it? Because as a marketeer, we always talk about the importance of communication, the importance of getting feedback from your customers, both your internal customers and your external customers, and making sure that at least is part of the process. And you know, if you then go against the feedback that you've got there, at least those people have been part of the process and understand it and kind of know where you're coming from and therefore are less likely to react in such a negative way.
That's right. There is, I mean, I'd say, you know, if we go back 20, 30 years ago, managers had the ability to turn around and say, and any good CEO would turn around and say, I made the best decision I had based upon the information that I had at the time. And we hear that in politics as well. We hear that all over the world. I have made the best decision based upon what I had. But technology is different now. We have we have partners. We've got a great tool that enables you to actually enact a strategy. It's kind of, let's say you're going to make a large change in a business and you want to make sure you've got the buy-in and you want to make sure your strategy works and it's tailored against the real working environment. Is there are simulations that are out there now that enable you to kind of compress time and enact strategy through either in a virtual or in a physical environment. And the way these things work is we tend to take all of the reports, the key business metrics, the monthly, quarterly reports where people would normally make a decision, and we need to get sufficient data to be able to imitate the environment in a way that people can feel truly immersed. That the decisions they make are true decisions. And we compress time. We say, where does the business want to be today? Where does it think it wants to be in the future? And then let's go and test what happens. And we compress time, basically, where you would make a decision based upon a quarterly or monthly report, you're going to now make that decision every 20 minutes. And we kind of speed the whole thing up just to see the consequence of decisions and action or inaction to be able to understand where the true constraints of these businesses are and what stops a business from being able to achieve where it wants to be in the future. There's a couple of things that tend to happen with these. First of all, we find out internally in the organization that wrong people are making the wrong decisions. We always tend to find the ideas person eventually. And we also see that how the different layers of an organization try to protect the lower levels of an organization, but also impact decision-making and communication, valid communication that needs to somehow float to the top of an organization to make sure that, that all the stakeholders' viewpoints are considered. Now, in our simulations, what tends to happen is the first day, businesses will fail. They always do. We've never had a business actually be successful at achieving their strategy, actually taking from where you are to where you want to be within the period of time expected in the strategy. The second day, the most remarkable thing happens. And you can never pinpoint where it's going to happen. But everybody is so used to making the same decisions they're always used to making on the data that they're always used to receiving in the manner that they always receive it, that they kind of get fixated and the blinkers go on. And something needs to happen. Something needs to happen cognitively for them to think, I'm making the same decisions I've always made and the decisions I'm making are no longer working. And therefore, there's quite a lot of stress involved in these sessions. You can imagine you're failing in front of your colleagues in your workplace. So quite a stressful first day. But the second day, what tends to happen is they've gone away, they've had time to think, they come back in again, and initially they'll start making the same decisions they made yesterday and things don't move on. But then suddenly, true innovation happens. They realize that I can't keep making this. And it's amazing how they then look across the room to all of their colleagues and peers and friends, and they just voice their frustration and they'll say, you know, I can't get my head around this. I can't understand why these things aren't working. By soliciting feedback and communication and dialogue from people around them and getting people focused on the ideas, suddenly they have this wealth of ideas and suggestions and things that could be trialed. And this thing happens quite quickly in the workplace. It propagates innovation. And ultimately, all of these changes start happening, but the authorization needs to go through the same hierarchical process it went through previously. But there's buy-in now because it's been properly thought through. The suggestions have much more clarity about what the problems are and what it's there to achieve. So eventually, second day, they achieve their strategy. They achieve where they want to be as a business. But as you go through the organizational levels, up at the apex, that's when you start to get board members and CEOs turning around and saying, but what's the external community going to say about this? What are our shareholders going to think about this investment? Is this the market we truly want to be in? And this kind of is the acid test behind all of the innovations that tend to propagate. Ultimately, what happens though is, yes, they're very successful the second day, but then when they turn around and they say, okay, but that was in a simulated environment, how real are the constraints and the issues that we saw? They tend to find that in the real world, those constraints are all absolutely valid and here in their workplace today. What they've recognized though is that the input mechanisms to expose these issues, these hidden issues and constraints, have remained hidden because they haven't got that necessary sensory tools set up. That exposure isn't there. So we always kind of tend to come back to what's missing, what do you need to have in place to make sure that that necessary sensory input is at least being given to you. And you find it's dialogue, you'll find it is diversity and inclusion, you'll find it is being open to suggestions from a broader audience than perhaps you have currently on. And also making sure that the whole organization actually understands where it's going and their part, the employee's part within it, in helping execute those strategies. These tools that are there today, they weren't there 20 years ago. You know, CEOs had the right, and I believe they all had the right to turn around and say exactly what they said. We made the best decision based upon the information that we had today. In the virtual reality world, in the high-tech world of where we are today, the ability to test before implementing is definitely there. And is it being embraced at the moment? No. So therefore, Chris, I come back to the Super League of football. Had this been tested in an environment such as what I've described, is they probably could have tailored the message significantly so that at least the supporters and the fans could buy into the reasons why, and that the existing establishment could decide whether they actually needed to make any changes to prevent this from actually happening and to air these frustrations. but it hasn't happened. So these frustrations have accumulated over the period of time that I've said, can't take it anymore. We need to go and start a new league. And that's a shame, because that's just a breakdown in communication. It's a breakdown in business relevance, and it's a breakdown in understanding what all of the stakeholders and shareholders needs that have forced this to happen. So, yeah, I think, again, we come back to the ability of the apex of the organization or institute or whatever it may be, having the necessary mechanisms in place to hear and understand the needs and requirements of all of its stakeholders.
Yeah, and actually, Kevin, I'd be interested to get your view on this, because one of the things that I hear a lot in the circles that I'm talking to at the moment is, you know, ethics, sustainability, ESG, it's all really very of the moment, because ultimately, versus say 3-5 years ago, investors now care about this, and investors are demanding that businesses take this seriously, whereas before it was all about the bottom line and share price. But again, this example of this week, you know, despite having so much backlash, the share price of Man United, Juventus, etc. has actually bounced massively, whereas the share price of all the other clubs that aren't part of this group have dropped. So how can we ever take ESG and ethics seriously?
Yeah. And there is, you can kind of go way back when you're thinking about these businesses. We had this similar one with, certainly when you consider shareholders and the share sites, you had the GameStop as well, where people were totally manipulating a market to give a certain outcome. So manipulation will always be there. And I say this with any system. So any type of governance that you tend to have in place, with any policies, what are you describing? You're describing the boundaries that you're focusing on. And that's it. You're describing the boundaries that you're focusing on. So if somebody wants to take advantage or work around the system, you've told them where you're focusing. So when you try to put good, solid business ethics in place and say, here's how we would like to do business, is it supported by the necessary mechanisms? Is it supported by policy? Is it supported by processes? Is it supported by how people actually execute work and make decisions? And often you'll find there are loads of fractions kind of between that. So a statement of intent is just that. It's just a statement of intent. And if you're then going to turn around and say, okay, so how far are we away from that intent, and what do we need to do to move towards it and to close those gaps? And you actually see a business doing that in terms of the actions it needs to take, then you can start to buy into, you know, we actually say and do what we mean to do. If it's just a statement that's there that people struggle to buy into because the way they're working today, tomorrow, and the plans for them to work over the next couple of months, if they can't see the necessary changes, it's just words that somebody at the top of an organization uses. It's something that's required on a website. So anything like that, any type of governance needs to be seen to cascade through the organization, so everybody can go, yeah, okay, this is an organization I can work for. This is an organization I believe in. And that actually leads to another really fundamental point, which is trust in the organization that I'm working for, the organization's trusting me to do my job the way I should work, and that we're actually trying to deliver what we say we deliver for the wider communities as well. So a trust-inducing organization can be incredibly powerful, but you have to have the right mechanisms in place. You have to have good managerial principles backed up with the necessary training to make sure that how we act as managers, how we treat our employees, and that we create a very open, transparent, fair organization exists and is demonstrated, then I think people can start to buy into governance policies. Without those necessary mechanisms, it's just a standalone statement.
What I'm loving about this conversation is how it's taking what could at some level be quite an esoteric concept, you know, a six-star business, and actually drilling down into, you've used the word mechanisms, you know, mechanics, Kevin, a few times. There's actually things that can be put in place to almost, you know, engineer like structurally engineer a six-star business. And that's quite exciting for me to think that it's not just a kind of an airy-fairy, oh, wouldn't it be nice if, you know, we had the six-star business, but there's actually things that can be done, you know, technologically, sociologically, to create the structures to that deliver a six-star business. I don't know, Evelyn, what's your take on what we've been listening to?
Exactly that. And I'm fascinated by the example, Chris, that you've raised around the football clubs. So, and then hearing Kevin's analogies and experience and the concept of the mechanisms and having the trust and the connections and the wider community feedback. So my very flat out sort of blatant, honest, direct question is, so where would you rate the current football clubs if you were to give them a star rating? Clearly they're lacking in the six stars. What would you say?
Well, I'm a Man United fan, so I'm a fan of one of the big six, and I would give my club 2 stars right now.
Yeah.
I have a slightly different perspective on it. So first of all, I've got to admit, I'm not a football fan. However, I'm helping 2 football clubs actually address the issues that we spoke about. So one is in Holland and the other one is in Russia. And they are all in that space taking a really good look at themselves in terms of how do they exist in the certain leagues that they operate in. So again, we took a snapshot of one of the clubs, given its size and its competition. You can actually, by trending things back over the last 10 years, you can see the very successful clubs took about a 5-year journey to mature and jump above the rest. And I think that, and we've demonstrated that across a number of clubs, that journey, that transformational journey, takes at least 5 years. Why does it take 5 years? It takes 5 years to get everybody to buy into it. You need to have those mechanisms in place. You need to consider, as I mentioned earlier, it's the strategy, it's the systems, it's the structures, it's the staff, and it's the sustainability. All of these things have to come together and play out over a period and be adjusted as the competition also moves as well. You have to kind of find a way of making a step change somehow. So where would I rate them now? I still think there's a great opportunity in the marketplace for those lower league clubs to make a significant difference and become a big player. We've seen it, we've mapped it, and therefore I can see the opportunities are just there. In a way, I kind of welcome a little bit of what's happening in their latest announcement. I often think a good industry shakeup creates the necessary turbulence or burning platform to create change as well. And it's never pleasant. It really isn't, but it forces people to consider what needs to change. And also, I tend to think, when we've seen it before with lots of large organizations as well, that those people who fail to take into account the needs of the stakeholders and shareholders might look like they have made the right decision in the short term, but the long-term buy-in and support from the shareholders can differ. And therefore, I would expect if the Super League forms and they continue doing this, I would expect within the first couple of years to at least see 1 or 2 of those clubs really start to falter in terms of their ability to perform. And that, unfortunately, is one of the consequences. And I think this is, the Super League has been put together with understanding, and this is my limited understanding of the Super League, but that there is kind of no disqualification. Once you're in, if you play miserably, you play miserably. But watch the fans disappear and watch the shareholders disappear and watch the stakeholders disappear if that is the consequence. My biggest concern is that the clubs that many fans have supported for generations within their family might just suddenly come to an end.
Yeah. So what's the recipe then? So Man United, you've given 2 stars. Kevin, I'm not sure what you think about the other, say, 5 clubs or 6 overall. Obviously, we love a good shakeup in the industry, like you say, because it creates the space for innovation and change. But given the way that they've handled themselves, and I haven't been privy to this at all, what's the recipe then for them to get out of it? So let's focus on these Super League clubs. What would you say they need to do? And Chris, I'd love to get your insights as well, to be a 6-star club.
I mean, I feel like the owners of some of these big 6 clubs might have really shot themselves in the foot, almost beyond repair. I think the clubs themselves have plenty of space to recover from this and actually benefit from this, because as Kevin said, it shaken things up so much. I can't imagine any other time when something in football has caught the attention of the Prime Minister and, you know, shone a light on other clubs in the world, like, for example, Bayern Munich, where in Germany the clubs have to have 51% fan ownership. You know, those sorts of structural changes are suddenly now on the agenda for English football. So, yeah, these are the sort of things that I'm suddenly paying attention to, and a lot of people are paying attention to, and I think, yeah, that can only be a positive thing.
Yeah, I agree, Chris. I think the first step should be an apology.
Yeah.
Or an apology from two sources. An apology from these clubs from not really considering all of their stakeholders, because they haven't. And from the outside, it kind of looks like greed. So I think they are going to struggle to actually be able to now go back and try to solicit buy-in and engagement from the stakeholder groups that are so clearly upset at what's been announced so far. I also think there needs to be an apology, though, from the existing membership bodies for not listening to and allowing the frustrations to build that have allowed this to take place anyway. Because that also needs, I mean, we talk about, you know, the leagues and these institutions also have a duty of care to service the members and to make sure they have the right, the necessary support mechanisms in place. And they clearly haven't been doing a very good job of that to cause these frustrations to happen. So I think there are a number of apologies required as a first step.
Yeah.
And would you say the five-year rule applies in these organisations as well to truly transform and reach that pinnacle or that level of...
Yeah, you know? I do. And the reason being is because these large clubs are complex. And whilst we can talk about them in terms of football, when you kind of expand out from that and you talk about, you know, the brands, the merchandising, the shareholder loyalty, the fan engagement, and as well as it being run as a, you know, a fully profitable business that has, you know, partnerships and memberships and branding and merchandise, they end up being quite complex businesses in their own right. And therefore, to create change, and to create change quickly, well, one is, yes, you create that burning platform, which they have done now, but you also need to have that well thought out and preferably tried and tested strategy before going to implement, rather than just implementing and seeing what happens. And that is the fear there in terms of that 5-year journey, is if they take that journey of, oh, well, let's try it and see, and let's just continue making small incremental changes to get to where we need to be. I would say it's going to be beyond the 5 years. I think you're going to be looking more like 7 to 10 years. As I mentioned earlier, though, there is technology out there and there are mechanisms out there and there is the necessary support out there to actually make it much less than 5 years. If companies are willing to kind of take that jump and listen to technology and simulations and actually try and test things before improving, they could potentially get the whole stakeholder groups behind them much quicker. But they have to try, test, and then implement, rather than implement and kind of make these incremental improvements. They have kind of communicated now. So there needs to be not an incremental improvement. It has to be something quite exponential. It's got to be something big, drastic, that allows people to buy into this now, or an admission of, we got it wrong, we need to go back and rethink and make changes. It's exposed, it's in the marketplace, so damage limitation potentially, or that they have something to entice and get the stakeholder groups to buy into this very quickly. We're not seeing it at the moment.
Chris, you're going to say something?
Yeah, just before we go, there was one nice story I did see yesterday, though, of a club responding the right way. Grimsby Town, from I think the third or fourth division, did a shirt amnesty, calling out to fans of all the big six clubs, if you're disenchanted, send us your shirt and we'll send you a Grimsby Town shirt for a proper local club that values fans. And they also said that they'd donate the big six shirts to poor communities in Africa and Asia as well. So that was a nice touch.
Excellent.
Now that sounds like a six-star football club.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And and a great note and way to end what's been for me a fascinating conversation. Never know where they go. It's one more piece. It's one more aspect. One more perspective of creating and you know, creating a 6-hour business and what that all means. So, Chris, really appreciate your time and your insight. Kevin, thanks also for being with us. Any last words or thoughts, Evelyn?
Oh, I think this topic alone, we could talk for hours, but I've really loved the journey and the insights and the topical relevance of these, of the football clubs in the UK. And so I just want to thank both of you for everything that you've shared on this episode, and I'm looking forward to listening to it again.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thanks.
Pleasure. Thank you so much. Take care for now. Bye.
Well, that's another episode done and dusted. Like you say, a bit of controversy, not from our perspective, but yeah, it was really interesting that Chris thought to bring that into the conversation about the Super League. What did you make of it all?
Oh, I loved it. I love the example, and I love that. I mean, look, let's face it, you know, football is such a big thing, and the fact that it is so different, controversial, but the topic that we have here of the 6-star business is applicable to any industry, to any business. Yeah. And it's fascinating. And I think we could have gone for another hour just talking about how those clubs, those 6 clubs, could have actually done things differently and gone into more detail than about what they could have done better, what would make them a 6-star business, and all of the stuff around it.
And ironically, might actually have ended up with what they wanted. So, yeah, fascinating aspect to the conversation around a 6-star business, and really interesting tapping into Kevin's evident expertise working with much larger companies and kind of just realizing that there are mechanisms that can be put in place to inform the development of a 6-star business. So, as always, there's going to be one or two nuggets in that episode. I hope you got them and you're able to apply them. And as part of application, Av, do you want to tell people what they can do?
Yeah, look, I would like to say, for those who are interested in potentially being a part of the 6-star business podcast, or if there's someone that you think that would be amazing for this conversation, please get in touch. Yeah, there's 6starbusinesspodcast@gmail.com, and there is a way in the notes below for you to send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. And yeah, I just want to thank you, Pete. Thanks for, you know, being part of this. And I've just loved that. I love that it's a little bit at left field. And I love the prospect that we can continue these amazing conversations. So
yeah, left field, but not offside.
That's the way. Exactly.
Fantastic. Yeah, great. Well, see you same time, same place next week for another great episode of the 6-Hour Business Podcast.
Thank you. Bye.